Welcome to the second hour's reading of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Michael. I'll be reading quick hits and the inside articles from the Odessa American, published Friday, November 18th, 2022. Quick hits. The Gifty Grinchmas Market. The Gifty Grinchmas Market has scheduled a pop-up Christmas market from 4 p.m. to 8 p.m. today and from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Saturday at the Horseshoe Arena, 2514 Arena Trail. Admission is $5 at the door, the proceeds of which will be donated to 311 Ministries. For more information, visit tinyurl.com/5RJB2YMY. Parks Legato Christmas Tree Market. Parks Legato Town Center, 7260 East Highway 191, has scheduled the Parks Legato Christmas Tree Market from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. today, Friday, and December 2nd, 10 a.m. to 9 p.m., Saturday, November 25th, 26th, and December 3rd, and from 1 p.m. to 6 p.m. Sunday, November 27th and December 4th. There will be fresh Christmas trees, wreaths, and garlands, plus free hot chocolate and more. All the proceeds from the event go directly to the Permian High School Band, who also staffs and helps coordinate the entire market. Admission is free. Visit tinyurl.com/BDH9DPJ9 or text TREE to 432-498-0251 to stay in the loop with event information. Free Tamale Sampling. The Gourmet Tamale will present a tamale sampling event from 6 p.m. to 11 p.m. today, Friday, at the Tailgate, 4401 North Big Spring Street, Midland. There will also be live music, local vendors, and more. Odessa Shakespeare Festival. Odessa Arts and the Great Shakespeare Roadshow will present Shakespeare's Macbeth at 7 p.m. today, Friday, at the Globe Theater, 2308 Shakespeare Road. General admission tickets are $10. For more information or to purchase tickets, visit odessashakespeare.org. UTPB Orchestra Concert. The UTPB Music Department has scheduled an orchestra concert at 7 p.m. today at the Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center, 1310 North FM 1788 Midland. Admission is free. For more, visit tinyurl.com/59R3ESFY. Registered sex offender accused of sexually assaulting 9-year-old girl. A registered sex offender awaiting trial for allegedly failing to notify OPD he had changed addresses is now accused of sexually assaulting a 9-year-old girl. According to an Ector County Sheriff's Office report, the girl's mother brought her to Medical Center Hospital on Monday morning after the child said Stephen Hoisington, Jr., 39, had shown her a sex toy. While waiting in the emergency room, the girl also told her mother Hoisington had asked her to kiss his penis. During a sexual assault nurse examination, the girl told the nurse Hoisington had penetrated her with his fingers and showed her pornography, the report stated. Moreover, during a later forensic interview, the child said Hoisington had performed oral sex on her, digitally penetrated her multiple times, and otherwise molested her. Hoisington denied all the allegations during an interview with an investigator on Tuesday and left the ECSO, according to the report. Hoisington was booked into the Ector County Jail Wednesday on suspicion of sexual assault of a child, a second-degree felony normally punishable by 2 to 20 years in prison. Texas Department of Public Safety records show Hoisington was convicted of sexual assault of a 16-year-old child in Harris County in 2001 and sentenced to 8 years in prison. He was arrested in May 2010 in Waller County on an aggravated robbery charge and in November 2011 in Houston on an unlawful possession of a firearm by a felon charge. He was sentenced to 10 years and 2 years in prison on those counts, and they were to run concurrently. Hoisington was paroled in July 2019, according to DPS records. In December 2019, Hoisington was indicted by an Ector County grand jury on one charge of failure to comply with registration requirements. According to the indictment, he failed to report in person to the Odessa Police Department to tell them about his intended change of address, his anticipated move date, or the address itself. He was released from the Ector County Jail on October 2021 after posting a $25,000 surety bond and is still awaiting trial. Hoisington is now being held on a $500,000 surety bond in the sexual assault case. Gray says he is an army in Ukraine, by Kim Smith. A former Texas House of Representatives candidate emailed a Wisconsin court Monday saying he's serving in the army in Ukraine, and that's why he wasn't able to make a court hearing last week. A Wisconsin judge issued an arrest warrant for Casey Gray, 40, after he failed to appear in court Thursday on three pending matters. Gray, who lost against State Representative Brooks Landgraf in a highly contentious battle in March, is accused of violating restraining orders in Walworth County Circuit Court in Wisconsin. He's scheduled to go to trial in January on one count of violating harassment restraining order in a case filed in April 2018, and he's facing two counts in a case that was filed 1 month later. The charges are misdemeanors. According to Gray's email, which was sent Monday morning, he has tried to call the court several times, but the calls have always gone to voicemail. He said he's left messages. Due to Russian missile attacks on the infrastructure, I was unable to travel or have power to make a call to the court, Gray wrote in the email. I am attempting to make my way to the U.S. to appear, he wrote, adding he hopes to speak with the judge to dissolve the warrant so he can safely travel back and appear without threat of arrest. According to court records, three of Gray's attorneys have withdrawn from the cases, the latest in June. No new attorneys are reflected in the court records. During his campaign, Gray said he had served in the Naval Special Warfare, the CIA, the Texas National Guard, and is a 100% disabled veteran from the U.S. Army. He also has said he was a diplomat for the State Department in Israel. However, the OA has been contacted by more than a dozen people who have sent hundreds of pages of documents that question some aspects of Gray's military service and whether he has worked for the CIA. Those people have also suggested Gray has exaggerated the nature of a helicopter incident in Korea and the injuries he sustained. Gray has declined to supply most of the documents the OA has asked for that would corroborate his claims, instead questioning the OA's motives. Gray tagged the OA on Facebook in March, announcing the false charges against me were ruled on and dismissed in full, when in fact only one charge, bail jumping, was dismissed. Gray, who was spotted in an Odessa Target the week of March 9th, wrote then that he had been in Ukraine since early March. Seventh grade Nimitz student arrested. Students at Nimitz Middle School reported to a teacher Thursday that Wednesday after school, a student told them he was going to bring a gun to school Thursday. The campus officer was immediately called, and after investigation, it was determined that the student, a seventh grade boy, did make the threat. The student was charged with use or threat of exhibition or use of firearms on school property or a bus, a Class A misdemeanor, a news release said. Police and campus leaders do not believe students nor staff were in danger, but every report like this will be taken seriously, and appropriate consequences will be the result, the release said. Children at Risk presents data on child care. To lay out child care availability and barriers, the nonprofit Children at Risk went on a tour around Texas and presented their findings to the Early Childhood Action Network Thursday. The presentation was made at a meeting of the Early Childhood Action Network held at the Region 18 Education Service Center. ECAN is an offshoot of the Education Partnership of the Permian Basin. The gathering included children at risk representatives, child care providers, and educators. Kim Kofron, director of early childhood for children at risk, said $5.9 billion in COVID relief funds have come into the state specifically for child care. So far, they have allocated 9 tranches of money. The data Kofron presented is through the 8th tranche, which was the end of September. We're expecting a 10th tranche by the end of the year. The big takeaway is that 74% of the funds went directly to child care providers across the state, which is exactly where we needed to go, and we were where it needs to continue. When we dig into those specific numbers, that's just over $4.1 billion that went to providers across the state. We know that we have about 13,000 providers, so that's a big number, but we have a lot of providers, Kofron said. I was just in Chicago at a national conference, and there are some states that have 1,500 providers across their state. We have 1.4 billion children under the age of 6 under working parents, Kofron said. About 80% of providers across the state, both homes and centers, applied for those funds. Even with the influx of money, Kofron said there is still a workforce crisis. We're still having centers close, so how can we continue to invest and make sure that those funds are not just one-time, but long-term investments, she added. Naomi Fletcher, Assistant Director of Early Childhood Policy at Children at Risk, said overall the number of child care seats has been declining. We have lost about 78% of all our child care seats over the last 5 years. That's not the direction we want to be headed. However, when we look at the children who need subsidy, quality care, we are moving in the right direction. For every rainy day, there's a sunshine to come somewhere down the road. We're able to provide more subsidized seats over the years. We want to keep that going, and we're also able to provide more quality-rated centers, Fletcher said. In the Permian Basin, there are about 9,300 seats available, which means you have about 23 zip codes that currently qualify as child care deserts, she said. This number is a little bit alarming. The Permian Basin is serving right now about 41 out of every 100 children with working families. In some places that we've been along this great tour, we've heard narratives of some of that is because there's a large demand for family kin providership as opposed to sending a child to a child care program. Everybody is not looking for a program to send their kids. They want somebody that they know, share some value, share some love with them, to take care of their children, but that's not always the case, Fletcher said. April Terrell, owner of Aladdin's Castle in Odessa, said staffing is the issue. We cannot find staff. As soon as you get them trained, they leave, so I have literally rooms closed down, so I'm unable to take more seats because I cannot find staff. Staffing is a huge percentage of the child care part that's missing, Terrell said. Terrell said child care workers are going to the local school district and Head Starts to work when they leave. I'm competitive in salary. However, I'm not competitive in benefits, she added. Andrea Misek, director of early childhood at Midland ISD, said it's important to note that even though the salaries might be competitive with the school district or other centers, the salaries that child care workers are often paid is still lower than what is needed to make ends meet and live in this area. So oftentimes, maybe they've worked in a child care center, and it's not necessarily that they go to another job that pays the same or might pay this much more, but maybe they're either moving out of the area or going to an oil field company and doing an office job, but getting paid more, even with relief funding going toward paying salaries. That still just can't match what's being offered by a lot of the oil field companies, Messick said. What's needed to make a living wage is anywhere between $22 and $25 per hour. The median wage for child care workers is $11.50 per hour. Between 2017 and 2021, Fletcher said, we've seen about a 55% drop in child care seats. Terrell said so many child care centers in the Permian Basin were established in the 1980s and 90s. So what is happening here is a lot of our directors are dying because we're old. We're old and we're tired, Terrell said. She added that there has to be some incentive to get younger people to open child care centers. I don't like competition, but I'm going to be gone one of these last times. I've had 5 daycare directors die within the last 10 years, so we're just done. We're dying, and when we die, our centers go, Terrell said. Fletcher said some of the community colleges and universities are trying to make it easier for people to find a path into a career in child care. When we're looking at subsidized care, again, it's mostly been on the upside with a little bit of drop in the pandemic, but you're pretty much trending in the same direction as the state, so that's good news. Then, when we look at TRS, Texas Rising Star, quality, there's a little bit of a decrease there, but I'm sure we can work together to encourage people that Texas Rising Star is a great program with great benefits. Those of us who are TRS certified will help you get through the process because we know all the tricks and the secrets. So we're going to go out there and find somebody that can mentor through this process, and we're going to get those percentages up because we don't want to see a 46% decrease next year, Fletcher said. Cofran said House Bill 619, which Children at Risk worked on, was passed during the last session. It required the Texas Workforce Commission to create an early childhood workforce strategic plan to improve the early childhood workforce and what's needed to fix the educator problem. Cofran said that report will be out in the next month. She noted that Children at Risk will be advocating to help parents get back to work with affordable child care and pre-kindergarten, support the child care workforce to support businesses, and invest in child care infrastructure in Texas. We know our Texas economy can't get back to where it needs to be if we don't have quality child care. You guys know that more than anybody in Midland, Odessa, with all your big boom and growth. You guys can't keep up, and you can't keep young families. You guys are a prime example of what's happening across the state. The Council for Strong America released a report in the last year looking at Texas, that Texas is losing close to just over $9 billion a year in our economy because of our lack of child care infrastructure, Cofran said. If we invested into infrastructure, we'd be able to make more as a state, Cofran said. Commissioners table JP training item. Ector County commissioners tabled an item to send newly elected justices of the peace for Precinct 3 and 4 to attend educational training in December before taking office in January 2023 during a special meeting Thursday. Ector County Judge Debbie Hayes said over the phone on Tuesday afternoon, the training is broken up into 3 parts, with the first starting in December. Hayes said the commissioners need to discuss this item with Bill Bowen and Elizabeth Baeza, Justice of Peace for Precinct 3 and 4, respectively, wouldn't be considered county employees until they are sworn in. Bowen, a Republican, defeated Democrat Gerardo Arzate 3,886 to 1,773, or 68.67% to 31.33% during the general election on November 8th for the Precinct 3 seat. Bowen is set to replace Woody Cupper. Baeza, a Democrat, won the Precinct 4 seat after she defeated Alfred Littleton and Jesse M. Porras III during the March primary. Baeza finished with 423 votes, 53.95%, while Littleton collected 217 votes, 27.68%, and Porras had 144 votes, 18.37%. Baeza will replace Eddie Spivey. Ector County Commissioner Precinct 4 Armando Rodriguez made a motion to table the item until the next meeting, December 6th. It was seconded by Ector County Commissioner Precinct 2, Greg Simmons. Rodriguez said that he had some questions about it since neither JP-elect was a county employee yet. Rodriguez and Simmons said they don't recall having sent JP-elects to training before they became county employees. Simmons said he wanted to check the liability since they won't be county employees and won't be under the county's coverage if something were to happen while they were traveling. I think it's just a matter of finding out what kind of liability we have for them not being actually employees at the time they go. I don't recall ever having somebody travel before they've been sworn in, Simmons said. The court also canvassed the vote totals for the general election held November 8th. Elections Administrator Lisa Sertuch said they had a total of 25,623 voters cast ballots out of a total of 83,521 registered voters, which gave the county a 30.68% turnout. Sertuch said it was a lower percentage compared to 2018. Commissioners voted 4-0 to accept the vote totals. Approved taking any necessary action to approve request for donation to repair two pool tables for the Northside Senior Center. Approved accepting a $600 donation from Iron Man Specialty Fluids LLC for the Northside Senior Center. Kept the county holiday schedule as it was posted. Hayes said they had received phone calls asking the schedule to be changed because school won't start again until January 3rd. New Year's Day is on a Sunday. Approved a fuel flowage fee per gallon increase to $0.20 based on the contract between Ector County and the FBO at Schlemmer Field Airport, and authorized the county judge to sign all documents associated with this agenda item. Tabled an administrative services agreement, contract number 76-415069, between UMR Incorporated and Ector County, and to ratify the county judge's signature. Approved the subrecipient agreement with Greater Gardendale Water Supply Corporation for the Gardendale Ector County project and authorized the county judge to sign. Approved the renewal with VSP, Vision Service Plan. Approved the revision of the procurement and procurement card, P card, policies and procedures, and authorized the county judge and other county officials to sign all documents associated with this agenda item. Approved the fiscal year 2023 budget amendment to sales tax fund, planning and development, departmental furniture and equipment, 0050255199, for $3,840 to subscriptions 005-0255207 for $4,695 from unreserved fund balance, 005-3310 for $8,535. Approved the fiscal year 2023 budget amendment to general fund, sheriff, law enforcement supplies, 001-360-5183 for $17,160 to special department equipment, 001-360-5507 for $9,883, and to donated revenues, 001-4171 for $27,043. Approved the attached fiscal year 2023 budget amendment for the increase in liability insurance premiums. Approved accounts payable fund requirements report for November 17, 2022 to review county financial statements and reports. Postponed a public hearing conducted by the Commissioner's Court regarding the proposed subdivision and manufactured home rental community regulations for Ector County, Texas regulations under a special meeting at 10 a.m. November 21st. The regulations may be A, reviewed and copied during regular business hours at the office of Eddie Landrum, Jr., the director of the Planning and Development Department of Ector County, Texas, in the Ector County Administration Building Annex at 1010 East 8th Street, Odessa, 79761. Telephone 432-498-4241. And B, reviewed and downloaded from the county's internet website at www.co.ector.tx.us. Odessa American Ticket, Weekend Entertainment Guide for the Permian Basin. A classic returns to the stage. Don't miss Midland Community Theater's production of A Christmas Carol, beginning November 25th. Tickets can be purchased online at tinyurl.com/4BSWP5RF. Starlight, Starbright. Don't miss the opening of Starbright Village at 6:30 p.m. on December 1st at McKinney Park. For more information, visit tinyurl.com/2P9Y627F. Home for the Holidays. Divas and Desserts returns for a fifth year. The event is scheduled for 6 p.m. December 16th at the MCM Grande Hotel. Get your tickets at tinyurl.com/3WJSFZH. Still going strong. Little Feat to celebrate Waiting for Columbus album at Wagner Noel by Michael Bauer. Scott Sherrard grew up loving the band Little Feat. It's been a dream come true as he was named as a new member to the band back in 2020 and has enjoyed every minute of playing and being on tour. He'll get a chance to stop by the Permian Basin in a few weeks when Little Feat performs at the Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center. The band will perform at 7:30 p.m. December 5th. "There's nothing like going through Texas," Sherrard said. "So much of my favorite music is from here. I can't wait to get some barbecue. As a guy who lives in New York City, that's the first thing I'm looking forward to." Over the years, the band has been a classic example of a fusion of many different styles and musical genres made into something utterly distinctive. They've transcended the boundaries, uniting California rock, funk, folk, jazz country, rockabilly, and New Orleans swamp boogie into a rich gumbo that has been leading people in joyful dance ever since. The band started in 1969 when Frank Zappa fired Lowell George from the Mothers of Invention and told him to start a band of his own. Soon after, Lowell connected with Bill Payne, which stirred up sparks before bringing in drummer Richie Hayward. The band was signed by Warner Brothers and began working on the first of 12 albums, and the rest became history. This tour commemorates the 45th anniversary of the Waiting for Columbus album. Sherrard and Leone are the newest members of the group. The Waiting for Columbus album is one of the most important albums in rock history and my own life, Sherrard said. "It's probably my own top 10 most influential records. To get to perform that album and set of music every night has been a very unique challenge. It's been a privilege for Tony Leone and I, the new guys. Tony and I were both raised on this album and played music from it. It's been a real challenge and rewarding experience. We have 3 more weeks of doing it in December, and then next year we're going to turn the page to new music. This will be a great celebration of that album and this band." Over the years, the band has seen changes. 50 years on the road cost them George, Hayward, and Barrere, but the music has carried them forward. Little Feat today contains Bill Payne on keyboards and vocals, Sam Clayton on percussion and vocals, Fred Tackett on guitar and vocals, and Kenny Gradney on bass, Sherrard on guitar and vocals, and Leone on drums. For Sherrard, following Little Feat as a kid inspired him to play music. "I saw my first Little Feat show when I was 13, Sherrard said. "I saw a couple of concerts on that tour, and it changed my life. My father's a musician, and I was raised in a very creative music household. They wrapped all these genres that I was supposed to in one laboratory. It didn't hurt at the time that I was just learning how to play the guitar seriously." It also inspired him to start his own band in junior high. "I wanted to put together my first junior high school band," Sherrard said. "The first band I put together, I was thinking about not only Little Feat, but also the Allman Brothers Band, Led Zeppelin, Rolling Stones. When you listen to their albums, you hear every style of American roots music in every song, and that still holds true today. It creates the high level of elite musicianship that you can have." The bands that approach everything narrowly are the ones selling themselves short of a true vision, especially in rock and roll. It's all about melding styles into one big gumbo, and there's no one better at that than Little Feat. During this tour, the crowds have been a blast to play for, Sherrard said. Little Feat crowds have always been filled with music fanatics, connoisseurs with a whole lot of love for the band and understanding of the deep roots of the band, Sherrard said. Those are the best fans. We've had an unbelievable great turnout at these shows. We've had some that are light, and I think that that has to do with some big sports game or the time period where we were touring during the pandemic because we've been touring for over a year. It's had its ups and downs during the tour, but the fans have been voracious. They're the best fans you could ask for. They give you so much energy. They've given me so much confidence to take this thing on, and it means a lot when you have to fill this role. It's been a great experience. For tickets to the show, go to tinyurl.com/RDJN6WFC. Chamberlain exhibit on display at Arts Council of Midland by Michael Bauer. In the high desert landscapes of Utah, artist Cody Chamberlain has found his own muse and spiritual solace in painting. He's gotten a chance to share some of his artwork with the Arts Council of Midland with his exhibition that is currently on display until November 28th. It's been in the works for quite a while, Chamberlain said. They reached out to me about a year and a half ago. They enjoyed my work. They came up to Utah to check out some of my works. We were talking, and they wanted to put my work on exhibit. I started talking to Arts Council of Midland Executive Director Daniel Holova and showing what I might have for the show. That was kind of it. They've been nice to work with. The exhibition features 14 of his paintings. Growing up, Chamberlain has always dreamt of being an artist. There wasn't a time where he knew he wanted to focus only on painting because it was always something he wanted to do. I don't think I had the moment because there was never any question, Chamberlain said. It was something I always did. I was one of those kids that drew on the walls. I think it was more something I always did. It was more of, how do I make this work functionally for my life? It was 6 years ago when I was able to make a living out of it. It was more of a progression, and it was amazing when that started happening. There was no rule book or playbook or anyone telling me that I had to do this and that to be an artist. It's kind of terrifying and wonderful at the same time. It's being your own boss and running everything as far as advertising. The paintings are mostly small ones, or at least small enough for him to carry to deliver to Midland himself. We'll get to the logistics of it, Chamberlain said. I was going to deliver the works myself. There are some larger ones that I have, but nothing too heavy. I can carry them by myself. That was just the size limitations I worked in. I made this journey heading to Texas. It worked out just fine. When delivering the paintings to Midland, it was his first time ever being in the Lone Star State. He spent his childhood roaming the high west desert of Utah. Chamberlain worked for the USDA Forest Service while earning his BFA in Art and Visual Communications from Utah Valley University. He has been a force in the art community in Utah for over a decade and a participant and contributor to the top-ranked art annual competitions of Utah for many years. When working with the Forest Service, Chamberlain said he would go out and paint different landscapes that he saw, but it's hard for him to describe some of his works. It's funny, people ask what art I do or what I paint, Chamberlain said. Sometimes I don't have the words because I'm a visual artist. It's easier just to look at my work. He's been thankful for the opportunity to showcase his works in the exhibition, which is not something he normally does. They've done a wonderful job, Chamberlain said of the Arts Council of Midland. It's a beautiful space. They've been very accommodating. I had plenty of time to get my work ready for the show. Typically, I don't do shows. I'm commission-based. It was interesting to do a show and build up work. That gave me a chance to get a cohesive body of work ready. It wasn't somebody dictating each piece. That was nice. I haven't been able to do that for a long time. I also haven't been to Midland or Texas before. It was new work for a new state. That allowed me to branch out a little bit, which is more than welcomed. For more information about Cody Chamberlain, visit tinyurl.com/53ED63RC. Here's a sidebar that accompanies the previous story. If you go, Cody Chamberlain quarterly visit through November 28th at Arts Council of Midland. Exhibit explores the works of Tom Lee by Michael Bauer. Tom Lee was one of the most well-known artists in the Southwest region, and people in the Permian Basin now have the opportunity to see some of his works at the Museum of the Southwest. The El Pasoan specialized in more than one form of art. In addition to being a painter, he was also a muralist, an author, illustrator, and war correspondent. His artistic style was as varied as his occupation, as he remains one of the most recognized artists and aesthetic innovators in Texas. Lee's works are currently on display at the Museum of the Southwest in an exhibition called Unbridled, The Art of Tom Lee. Tom Lee is an iconic West Texas artist, Museum of the Southwest curator Matthew Ward said. Born in El Paso, this exhibition covers a little bit of everything from his career. He was very prolific. He was a studio painter. He was an illustrator and a muralist. He was also an artist. He's illustrated books that he wrote, and we have those books here for people to look at. Lee was born in El Paso in 1907, where he also died in 2001 at the age of 93. His father, Thomas Callaway Lee Jr., was mayor of El Paso from 1915 to 1917, where he made a public declaration that he would arrest Pancho Villa if he dared enter El Paso after Villa raided Columbus, New Mexico in 1916. Villa responded by offering 1,000 pesos gold bounty on the mayor. For 6 months, the younger Lee and his brother, Joe, had to have a police escort to and from school, and there was a 24-hour guard on the house. During the Great Depression, Lee found work from New Deal art projects. He painted numerous murals that were in post offices, including one at the original post office in Odessa, with his painting titled Stampede. It remained in the original Odessa post office until the 1970s, Ward said. When the post office switched locations, the mural was moved along with it. By the 90s, it was in rough shape. There were stains on it. Somebody had taken a knife to it and slashed it, but in the 2000s. However, the painting would get a new lease on life when the Odessa Arts Council and the Ellen Noel Art Museum put together a restoration project for the painting. The painting was then moved to the Ellen Noel. However, it has since temporarily been moved to the Museum of the Southwest while the Ellen Noel undergoes renovation. I'm really excited that the Stampede is here. It'll be here with us while the Ellen Noel is undergoing renovation, Ward said. It'll be here for the next 3 years, even after the exhibition. This is a signature Odessa Midland work of art, and I'm happy that it can remain on display here. In 1941, Lee became a war correspondent for Life magazine, a position he would hold until the end of World War II. Traveling all over the world with the United States military, Lee would paint some of his powerful images based on what he saw from the war on the front lines. Some of his works from the war, including The Price and the 2,000-Yard Stare, are also included in the exhibition. Some of the paintings of The Price are things he witnessed firsthand, Ward said. What I find amazing is, yes, he's capturing the bravery and solidarity of war, but he's also capturing the trauma of war. The 2,000-Yard Stare is a sign of PTSD. Decades before it was even identified as a condition. He's identifying the condition of a shell-shocked soldier, which I think is amazing. The exhibit is on display until January 8th. We wanted to do something about Tom Lee because he has so much importance, Ward said. He's an old master of the Southwest. To put it together was the relationship between the Museum of the Southwest and the El Paso Museum of Art. They loaned us so many of these great works. The Tom Lee Institute also helped. The mural is such a highlight of the exhibition. Being able to install it and bring it from Odessa to Midland is a huge thanks to the Ellen Noel Art Museum. Massive thanks to them for helping us. For more information on the exhibit, go to tinyurl.com/YP83MU9R. Here's a sidebar that accompanies the previous story. If you go, Unbridled, The Art of Tom Lee, now through January 8th, where? The Museum of the Southwest. Magical Cirque Christmas to swing in to WNPAC. The world's greatest entertainers will unite for a spellbinding and incredible holiday production of A Magical Cirque Christmas. The production will take place at 6:30 p.m. November 20th at the Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center. Magical hostess Lucy Darling takes the audience through an evening of dazzling performers and breathtaking cirque artists, accompanied by many well-known holiday music performed live. Tickets can be purchased online at tinyurl.com/3FHKXR9Y. Here's a sidebar that accompanies the previous story. If you go, A Magical Cirque Christmas, 6:30 p.m. November 20th. Lindsey Stirling Snow Waltz Tour to come through Midland. For over a decade, Lindsey Stirling has enchanted audiences across the globe by performing a certain spellbinding magic with her electronic violin. She'll be performing next week at 8 p.m. November 21st at the Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center. On her new album, Snow Waltz, the classically trained musician, songwriter, dancer, and author finds herself fully in her element, sharing a selection of holiday classics and original songs that evoke intense emotion through her arrangements and melodies. Here's a sidebar that accompanies the previous story. If you go, Lindsey Stirling Snow Waltz Tour, 7 p.m. November 21st, Wagner Noel Performing Arts Center. Where to purchase tickets? tinyurl.com/MT9JX76B.
This is Reed, and this is the Midland Reporter Telegram Health and Wellness for Wednesday, November 16th, 2022. Smoke out is when smoke-free life can start. Quote, you don't have to stop smoking in one day. Start with day one, end quote. That is the foundation for the American Cancer Society's Great American Smokeout. This is an annual event on the third Thursday in November to encourage people who smoke to start their journey to a smoke-free life. It doesn't matter how old you are or how long you have been smoking, quitting will improve your life, improve your health. Some improvements begin within minutes and continue for years. After the first 20 minutes, your heart rate and blood pressure lower. After a few days, the carbon monoxide level in your blood drops to normal. 2 weeks to 3 months, your circulation improves and your lung function increases. Within the first year, coughing and shortness of breath decrease. 1 to 2 years, your risk of heart attack drops dramatically. 5 to 10 years, your risk of stroke decreases and your risk of cancers of the mouth, throat, and voice box is cut in half. After 10 years, your risk of lung cancer is about half that of a person who is still smoking, and your risk of cancer of the bladder, esophagus, and kidney decreases. And after 15 years, your risk of coronary heart disease is close to that of a person who has never smoked. Every year, tobacco use causes 1 out of 5 deaths in the U.S. Tobacco smoke contains more than 7,000 chemical compounds, hundreds of which are toxic, and at least 70 of which cause cancer. Smoking also contributes to other health issues, such as cataracts, altered taste and smell, heart disease, stomach ulcers, premature aging of the skin, increased risk of broken bones, stroke, tooth and gum disease, COPD, and asthma, decreased immune system, wounds taking longer to heal, and increased risk of many kinds of cancers. Quitting smoking is not easy, but it is possible. There is help available to get you started on the path to quitting. To have the best chance of quitting and reducing your risk of cancer, you need to have a plan. Know your options and obstacles and where to go for help. There are nicotine lozenges, patches, gums, and there are prescription medications your provider can prescribe to help you quit smoking. To take the first step, talk to your healthcare provider or call the National Quit Line number at 800-QUIT-NOW, 1-800-784-8669. To speak to an intake specialist that will gather information to get you enrolled into the program. The intake specialist gathers information, tobacco history, preferred nicotine replacement, lozenge, gum, patch, and discusses a quit date or plan. There are support coaches available 24/7 to offer people who smoke, vape, or chew tobacco support. The intake process takes about 15 minutes. The coaches and you will decide on a plan that usually consists of 3 to 5 calls between you and your coach. You can always make additional calls if you are struggling and need additional support or encouragement. If you also feel that you may need prescription medication, e.g. bupropion SR or Chantix, to help you stop smoking, talk to your provider to see which medication may be best for you. The Midland Health Lifestyle Medicine Center offers a smoking cessation program. This program is self-paced through your smartphone. There are no classes, no phone calls, and no pressure to quit. Best of all, Pivot is available free of charge for a limited number of participants. You can call 432-221-5433, and someone from the Lifestyle Medicine Center will email you a link to the Pivot program. Pivot includes mobile app, personalized daily recommendations and activities, free nicotine replacement products proven to help reduce cravings, the Pivot Smart Sensor, increase motivation while tracking progress, coaching support, a dedicated human coach available via in-app text. Working with a Pivot coach is optional. An online user community. Share and learn from others on the same journey. More kids. If you smoke cigarettes, checkups. Please join the others who decades, are participating in the Great American Smoke Alarm schedule of well-child visits to check fit on children's growth, development, and health, and offer parents the chance to talk with their children's doctor, catch kids up on scheduled vaccinations, and more. Now, a study in JAMA Pediatrics sheds light on both growth and inequality in well-child visits. The check-ins are associated with better health outcomes, fewer hospitalizations and emergency room visits, and improved provider-parent communication. Health and Human Services researchers at the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality analyzed data from more than 36,500 children documented in the Medical Expenditure Panel Survey, an ongoing nationwide survey on who uses healthcare in the United States. To track whether visit compliance had grown, they compared data from 2006 and 2007 to 2016 and 2017. The researchers found that 14.5% more kids completed their recommended well-child checkups in 2016 and 2017, raising the number of children in compliance from 47.9% to 62.3%. But that growth was far from equal. When the researchers dove into the data, they found that non-white children trailed their counterparts in well-child visits. About 68% of white non-Hispanic children were compliant in 2016 and 2017, compared with 52.5% of black children and 58% of Hispanic children. Not surprisingly, insured status mattered. Though adherence levels rose more for kids covered by public insurance and kids without insurance coverage, only 31% of children who weren't insured made the recommended visits in 2016 and 2017. While 67.6% of children whose parents had attended college went to their well-child checkups, about 50% of children whose parents did not complete high school didn't get checked up on schedule. There were regional gaps, too. Some 79.3% of kids from the Northeast made it to the recommended visits, but only 65.3% of children in the Midwest, 58.2% in the South, and 55.2% in the West did the same. To correct the imbalance, the researchers write, policymakers and medical professionals must work to improve both access and professional engagement in marginalized communities. Although researchers are still working to understand why parents skip well-child visits, factors such as work, transportation, and patient education are thought to play a role. Mayo Clinic Q&A. genetic counseling after a cancer diagnosis is important. Dear Mayo Clinic, I was diagnosed with ovarian cancer 2 months ago. My oncologist recommended that I undergo genetic testing as part of the treatment plan. Why is this recommended since I already have cancer? What is the benefit of testing, and what information will it provide? Answer: genetic counseling can be an important part of a cancer journey. A genetic test looks for specific harmful gene changes, called mutations or pathogenic variants, that can cause someone to develop a genetic condition. Gene changes are like spelling errors within the body's instruction manual. Most genetic tests look for changes in a group of genes called a panel. However, testing may look for changes in a single gene when there is a known genetic mutation in your family. The most common genes typically thought of related to cancer risk are BRCA1 and BRCA2. These genes are associated with breast and ovarian cancer. It is known that changes in other genes can increase risk for these cancers as well. During a cancer journey, genetic testing can help your care team make recommendations for treatments and surgical procedures. For example, some cancers associated with genetic mutations respond better to certain types of chemotherapy treatments than others. Similarly, genetic testing can help patients make surgical decisions. For instance, a patient with breast cancer can use the information to determine between a lumpectomy or a mastectomy. The results of genetic testing can help your family members. Potentially, your children, siblings, nieces, and nephews could have inherited the same gene mutation. If you had a change in the BRCA gene, and the testing showed this, your family members have a higher risk for breast and ovarian cancer. Knowing this information can be valuable to help them establish early screening schedules and make healthy decisions throughout their lives. It is important to know that most cancers are considered sporadic, meaning the cancer happens randomly or has environmental influences, such as smoking and lung cancer. About 25% of cancers are considered familial. This is when multiple members of a family are affected by cancer. These family members have some shared genetic factors in combination with shared environmental factors that lead to the development of these cancers. About 10% of cancers are considered hereditary or have a single specific genetic component that can be tested and increase a person's risk for developing cancer. While you can't change your genes, you can control some aspects of your environment, such as diet and physical activity level, as well as alcohol and tobacco use. That is why it's still so important to live a healthy life, regardless of your personal and family genetic history. Treating pneumonia involves curing infection, preventing complications. Pneumonia causes more than 1 million hospitalizations and 50,000 deaths per year in the U.S., according to the American Lung Association. Pneumonia is an infection that inflames the air sacs in one or both lungs. The air sacs may fill with fluid or pus, causing cough with phlegm or pus, fever, chills, and difficulty breathing. Pneumonia can range in seriousness from mild to life-threatening. It is most serious for infants and young children, people older than 65, and people with health problems or weakened immune systems. Signs and symptoms of pneumonia vary from mild to severe, depending on the type of germ causing the infection, age, and overall health. Mild signs and symptoms often are similar to those of a cold or flu, but they last longer. Vaccines are available to prevent some types of pneumonia. The vaccination guidelines have changed over time, so be sure to review your vaccination status with your healthcare team, even if you recall previously being vaccinated for pneumonia. Treatment. Treatment for pneumonia involves curing the infection and preventing complications. Specific treatments depend on the type and severity of the pneumonia, as well as age and overall health. Treatment can include antibiotics. These medicines are used to treat bacterial pneumonia. It may take time to identify the type of bacteria causing your pneumonia and choose the best antibiotic to treat it. If your symptoms don't improve, your healthcare professional may recommend a different antibiotic. Cough medicine. This medicine can be used to calm your cough so that you can rest. Because coughing helps loosen and move fluid from your lungs, it's a good idea not to eliminate your cough completely, though. In addition, you should know that very few studies have looked at whether over-the-counter cough medicines lessen coughing caused by pneumonia. If you want to try a cough suppressant, use the lowest dose that helps you rest. Fever reducers, pain relievers. These include drugs such as aspirin, ibuprofen, and acetaminophen. You can take these as needed for fever and discomfort. Although most symptoms ease in a few days or weeks, the feeling of tiredness can persist for a month or more. Quote, walking pneumonia, end quote, is an informal term for pneumonia that isn't severe enough to require bed rest or hospitalization.
To Your Good Health by Dr. Keith Roach. TERP procedure can bring complications. Dear Dr. Roach, I'm an 80-year-old male who learned from a much younger male about the tremendous improvement he's had in his life since undergoing a TERP, transurethral resection of the prostate procedure. I hadn't known he was having a problem and had been through the drug routine that was providing him with limited improvement. Against my aversion of being operated upon, he subsequently convinced me to investigate and ultimately have the operation. That was a few months ago, and I have subsequently introduced the idea to many other males or their wives, none of whom had heard about the simple overnight operation. The benefit of the drug therapy, which left me with persistent symptoms of not being able to urinate for a long time, as long as 10 to 15 minutes, was insignificant relative to the result of the TERP operation, which had greatly improved both of these problems, with the nighttime call to the bathroom now taking closer to a minute. There must be many more males and their wives who would benefit from knowing that the operation is simple and effective. Answer. I am very glad you had such good results after your surgery. I've had several letters like yours wondering why I don't recommend TERP or other surgical procedures. There are many, including those that use cold microwave or laser energy to remove prostate tissue as first-line treatment. The answer is that I get still other letters about, and have also seen in my own patients, the unusual but not rare complications men can get from TERP surgery. It's a hard lesson to learn in medicine that what works amazingly well for one person doesn't work at all well for another, even if they seem to have exactly the same problem and might be similar in many other ways. Dear Abby, for Friday, November 18th. Beau maintains presence on multiple dating sites. Dear Abby, I'm a widowed woman who met a gentleman online 2 years ago. We met in person and get along really great. Everything seems perfect, but my girlfriends keep telling me they see his profile on numerous dating sites. When I asked him about it, he said he had closed the accounts. Well, close friends say they are concerned because he is on a lot of these sites even now. I'm at a crossroads with this. I'm not sure if he's casually looking to see if there's anyone better or if he's stroking his ego with contacts from these dating sites. What should I take away from this? Perplexed in Florida. Dear Perplexed, the first thing to pay attention to is that you don't feel you can trust him at his word. Ask some of your vigilant girlfriends to reach out to him on some of those sites they see him on. If they receive a response, end the romance if what you want is an exclusive relationship. Dear Abby, my sister-in-law and I used to be close, closer even than I was to my actual sister. 3 years ago, we were on a trip and had an argument and didn't speak for more than a year. We have since made up, but our relationship isn't the same. We are friends with a close group of women and have fun in a group. But anytime I invite her to do something, she will accept and then cancel at the last minute or tell me she can't go when I contact her asking what time we should meet. Her answers to my texts are cold and short. I'm tired of being constantly hurt by this rejection. Should I just quit trying and accept that this is our new dynamic? To try or not to try? Dear Try or Not, your sister-in-law is either extremely rude or still trying to punish you for that argument you had 3 years ago. It's time to step back and accept new dynamic, because pushing for more isn't working. Dear Abby, our daughter is being married soon. She has invited our best friends of 30 years to her wedding, but she refuses to invite their adult daughter because she has treated her parents very disrespectfully throughout the years. Our friends tolerate this because she's their only child. I understand my daughter's reasoning, but I told her, I'm afraid we will lose their friendship if she does this. Our friends' feelings get hurt very easily. How do we deal with this? Conflicted Mama in Texas. Dear Mama, if your friendship with this couple depends upon how your daughter treats her daughter, that relationship is already fragile. This is your daughter's special day. I do not think she should be strong-armed into inviting someone because you're afraid your friendship with this couple will end if her daughter isn't included. Deal with this by not involving yourself.
Thank you for joining us for the readings of the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.